Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm with my gracious co-hosts, Pamela Chaddock and Chuck Thurston. Good day to you guys. How are you?
Hey, good morning.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, and you will notice, listeners, I'm just introducing two people. That can only mean one thing. Yes, Paula is visiting her wonderful daughter and son-in-law today back east. And we have Marvin, I'm sure, involved in something else, probably family related. Who knows? But he's taking the week off and, in fact, taking next week off as well. So it's just the three of us holding down the fort here and talking to you about God and what God might have to say to us. No, I'm not going to be channeling. I am going to be looking here at your answer book paper four, section four, the realization of God. Last week, we covered God's unchanging character. And I just have a question to you two. Does anything come to mind about what we talked about last week or what we're about to talk about when we're thinking about the realization of God or his unchanging character or anything else about nature for that matter?
Well,
it's early in the morning, isn't it?
Yes. Well, there were a lot of interesting things in that last section, to be sure. But I like the idea that the eternal God is incapable of wrath and anger in the sense that these human emotions, and as man understands such reactions. So obviously God is in a different category. We tend to anthropomorphize our deity concept. I think they're trying to tell us something there about the nature of God. You know, we can strive to be like God, but we're not quite like him yet.
I think you're right, Chuck. And when I think about that these days, I also think they're trying to tell us something about the nature of true personhood. Because I think anybody, it's a part of the maturation process for all of us as we go forward, that as we begin to look at how we navigate life, how we quote unquote get what we want, God help us, and you know, how we best serve others, how we love, all these ways that we can exercise our human will, it strikes me that as we grow and mature, we learn that certain things don't work so well. You know, so for instance, the idea of getting angry with someone in order to get something done. Mm-hmm. You know, it may work in the short term, but it leaves a residue. It definitely has consequences in terms mm-hmm. of whether somebody necessarily wants to cooperate with you in the future. It may have worked really well in the past where, you know, fear was the dominant reaction with people, mm-hmm. someone in authority, but that's surely not true today.
mm-hmm.
You know? Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that, it just occurred to me as you're saying that when one person gets angry with another, it's also kind of a form of punishment. You know, you try to punish the other person to manipulate them into changing whatever it is that they're angry about.
Yeah.
But the book is very careful that punishment should always be a group function. You know, it's like the justice issue. You know, so personally,
definitely justice.
Decide,
yes,
okay,
definitely.
I'm going to administer justice on this person through my anger. It's kind of a violation of that principle.
Yeah.
I mean,
you
can certainly communicate with the other person. You can say, well, I'm feeling angry about this or that, and maybe we need to talk about it, right? And that's different from just venting or attacking with the intention to hurt or do harm mm-hmm. to the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it
Go ahead,
just
Pam.
Shows how... Yeah, shows how distant someone is from doing the will of God. It's like it's a baseline reaction as opposed to a stretch ahead into godlikeness.
Right.
In fact, you know, what kind of ties in also is from this section under paragraph number 4 of the previous one, said God's wisdom consists in the unqualified perfection of his infinite universe insight, and this divine foreknowledge effectively directs the creative free will. So, as we tie in to God's will, his foreknowledge knows just exactly where we need to go next. So I think it's just a matter of our connection to that spirit that determines what our reaction will be, or action.
mm-hmm. And the perception of that through the lens of our own experience also. I mean, that's kind of what's tricky about the position we're in, or the opportunity we have, depending on how you want to look at it, is that we're in the crux of blending the human and the divine.
Yes.
And we do have this divine spirit of the adjuster within it, you know, as you're alluding to. But we also have our feet on the ground, and you know, we have the will, right? I mean, when we talk about doing the Father's will, we're sort of like giving our will to the Father, or allowing it to be directed, you know, by the divinity of that spirit. But yet, it's still up to us to figure that out and to do that. And you know, like we were just, you know, I think as Andre said a minute ago, or maybe you were saying, we will make mistakes. It's inevitable that we'll make mistakes.
For sure.
So that's
what's
kind of the beauty of it, that there's this evolving, you know, collaboration between the human viewpoint and the divine guidance. And we have to learn how to blend that, you know, the never-ending blending they talk about.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, and when you think about that, never-ending blending, and you think about the idea that our injunction, the injunction to human beings, whether it be in North America or Europe or Africa or South America or Australia or Asia or anywhere on the planet is one and the same from God. Be you perfect, even as I am perfect. The idea, be like me. We're given that injunction. We're not told to be that way all at once, but we get that injunction, be like me, and they make the point, there should be no problem with that for you guys, because even before that, God has chosen and first to be like you.
Right.
To literally indwell us and to try to become us. Now, he's not going to try to become the worst version of ourselves. Mm. He's not capable of that.
That's up to us.
That's right.
That's
We've got to let him in to be what he wants to be in us. But the key there is he doesn't want to take over in the sense of, okay, give me the controls now because you ain't doing it right.
Yeah.
It isn't like that.
No,
although it's been portrayed that way by many religionists over time, that the surrender needs to be of a kind. I mean, it does need to be wholehearted, but does that mean that he wants us to do nothing, to negate our personality? And I'm not sure that it's like that. I don't think it is. I think what it is more a matter of, are we willing to do his will? Because to do his will is to allow us an opening to have him truly be in partnership with us in a particular task. Now, that's more a question than a statement, but what are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I mean, the whole point of doing, you know, or at least having the intention or the desire to do the Father's will, I mean, that's so important because that's the only way we have of knowing the Father. If we're just always going off of our own self-interested motivations and never consider anything else, we're never going to know the Father. So that concept or that approach to life, decision-making and stuff, is inherently an invitation, you know, kind of like you're suggesting, an invitation for guidance. You know, let's do this together because I know your ways are higher than my ways. You know, how did Isaiah put that? You know, your ways are, your thoughts are higher than my thoughts. You know, not to discount.
Yes, Isaiah.
Not to discount our thoughts.
Yeah.
But, right. But just to know that there is a higher perspective or there is this foreknowledge or there is the best thing for each of us to do is known by God. The only thing is that we don't know it. So we have to bridge that gap in some way, and our desire and our intention is sort of key to that, even if we can't presume. I mean, we can't presume to know the Father's will unless we know the Father, right? And, and the way to know the Father is to try to do it as well. You know, it's so interesting the way they go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, that has always been such amorphous understanding, the will of God. What does that mean? But until I really got to understand that the fruit of the Spirit lets me know who God is. And so that's like, you know, am I serving lovingly? Do I have unselfish devotion? You know, is my loyalty courageous? And all those beautiful fruit, that's the gauge that lets me know how on track I am. So, because that's who God is. So that's the will of God, and that's who he is. So,
wonderful.
How I approach it, because otherwise, how you break down the will of the Almighty, infinite, perfect, you know?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, we slowly evolve a sense of standards, you know, and in a way you could look at the fruits of the Spirit that way, that, okay, I want to uphold these standards because I know they're godlike. and that at least gives me a starting point on the path. And it also gives me a way to, like an alert, I'm deviating too far from the standards and principles. I mean, truth, beauty, and goodness kind of function in the same way. You know, to be conscious of being motivated to increase the quantity of truth, beauty, and goodness in the zone of influence that we each have. You know, we each have a zone of influence. That's one way we can kind of think about that. You know, our encounters with other people, our conversations, however we participate in reality, we have a zone of influence that we bring to that. And to uphold those standards, like you're saying, Pam, and then truth, beauty, and goodness, those are places at least to start, and I'm grateful to have that kind of guidance, even though it's not the living guidance that we just can discover within, but it's, at least we know when we're consistent with those standards, which is, I think, is a big help. So I think that's a good way to approach it.
I don't know. To me, it is living.
Well, to do those things, that's very good. It is. I mean, we can kind of set them aside as sort of an abstract thing, but then you're right.
Yeah.
When we actually try to be that way or grow into those things, then that's exactly. That's where our experience hits the road or something like that, mixing metaphors.
Yeah, right.
Wonderful.
One other thing I've noticed about this thing of trying to do the Father's will is the way they talk about Jesus in relation to that. Like, here's one example. This is from the Mount of Transfiguration, where they say that after this celestial visitation, Jesus sought to know his Father's will because he didn't get confirmation from the Father. If you remember that scene on the Mount of Transfiguration, the representative of the Eternal Son signed off, the representative through the Mother Spirit signed off, good job. But he didn't hear from the Father. So that led him to think that, okay, I must have more to do here. Of course he did. But the way they put this is interesting. They say, after this celestial visitation, Jesus sought to know the Father's will and decided to pursue the mortal bestowal to its natural end. So he sought to know his Father's will, but he decided to pursue the mortal bestowal to its natural end. So
very interesting, isn't it?
Because
in theory, he knew it. In theory, he knew what the Father's will would be, for the rest of his life. But in its outworking, humanly, he did not. He probably chose not to foreknow immediately how this would all play out, even though he might be able to forecast and say, this may not work out so well. I think he probably realized that very, very quickly. I mean, that may have been some of his meditation over the 40 days after his baptism, because there he did have access to his divine mind and all, and he knew that. And even though you're talking about the transfiguration, I believe now, he still at that point, he'd done the will of the Spirit, he'd done the will of the Son, but he noticed, this is my beloved Son, give heed to him. Oh, I have more to say, huh? Thanks, Dad. to be irreverent at all, but he did not get his exit papers at that point.
Right. Very true. Something similar happened in the Garden of Gethsemane. I was just trying to find it. But there, too.
You mean regarding when he prayed about the cup?
Prayed three times and then was comforted by the mighty angel who came down to touch him and all of that.
Sure.
Huge, hugely dramatic moment
yes.
in the
oh
whole
my.
Arc of the bestowal. And it was, you know, what he was seeking to know, the Father's will. You know, is this
yes.
really, really, really what's supposed to happen?
Yeah, right. Are you sure?
And yeah. he, where did they say that? Yeah, well, he says, Father, I know it is possible to avoid this cup. All things are possible with you. But I have come to do your will. And while this is a bitter cup, I would drink it if it is your will. So he's questioning. Right?
Yeah, right.
And when he had thus prayed, a mighty angel came down by his side, speaking to him, touched him, and strengthened him. And then later...
Are you in 182, section 3?
I am, yeah. 182, section 3. Yeah, I think in the fourth paragraph, what did they say?
The third time, yes. Right.
Yeah. Where he's again decided that the guidance was to allow events to take their natural course, that was the Father's will. I mean, the angel
right.
told him, look, you know, yours is a bestowal. You know, he got reminded, you know, physical death is part of the experience of a bestowal.
Yeah.
You have to go through that just like your human children do.
Mm-hmm.
But the how to handle this moment in time, this crisis, I mean, it really was a crisis. You know, he's worried about the apostles and what's going to happen to them if he's put to death and all of that. And they say somewhere in here that he somehow got the message that, you know, he was to allow events to take their natural course. Let me see if I can find that. But it was kind of like the thing on the Mount of Transfiguration. It wasn't like he heard a voice in his head saying, do this, do that, do this. He had to figure it out. And he came to the conclusion or the realization that this is his best understanding of the Father's will, something like that.
Right.
So I think we're all often in positions like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where?
Well, yeah, except maybe not hearing as clearly
right.
as he was at this point. Of course,
right.
of course, he did the work. This is the thing. This is the thing I like to try to remind readers. It's you know, I can't prove this, but it's my opinion that everything about why he was able to access the divine mind was because he had done all the work up to his baptism and really effectively would have fused with his thought adjuster had that been part of the plan. And it was neither part of the plan for that thought adjuster nor his plan, and so it didn't happen. You know, but he had done all the work that would have been required as a human being to make it happen. And what a remarkable thing. And he chose not to, I mean, there are things that are practically unstated in the Urantia book about these kinds of things, but they're stated very clearly by their non-occurrence. And so there were no miracles that happened prior to his baptism, not one. Right? People forget about that. He had that same power, but he was deliberately not using any of that power. He had chosen to go through that period of his life entirely as the Son of Man in order to get truly the true human experience, no cheating. No cheating.
You got to do stuff just like everybody else does.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was after his baptism, wasn't it, that he assembled the apostles and really began his public ministry.
Yeah.
So that's when, you know, like the water and the wine and all that kind of thing happened after his baptism, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that, if I got the timeline straight?
All of those things happened after.
Anyway,
sequence is important.
Yeah, oh no, it totally is.
Yes.
I found this paragraph where it makes the comment about Jesus realizing the Father's will in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's just to illustrate the same kind of, you know, thing that, you know, what, well, let me just read it. They say, earlier in the evening, it had not seemed so difficult to drink the cup, but as the human Jesus bade farewell to his apostles and sent them to their rest, the trial grew more appalling. Jesus experienced that natural ebb and flow of feeling, which is common to all human experience. And just now, he was weary from work, exhausted from the long hours of strenuous labor and painful anxiety concerning the safety of his apostles. While no mortal can presume to understand the thoughts and feelings of the incarnate Son of God at such a time as this, we know that he endured great anguish and suffered untold sorrow, for the perspiration rolled off his face in great drops. I mean, this is so cinematic, so real too. And then this is the kicker. They say he was at last convinced that the Father intended to allow natural events to take their course. He was fully determined to employ none of his sovereign power as the supreme head of a universe to save himself. So again, it's interesting how they put that. He was at last convinced. So this was, he was working this out, he was appealing to the Father for knowledge of his will, but he was also working it out in his own mind. You know, so the way they put that, you know, it's, they don't say, he at last heard the voice of God in his head and it told him to allow events to take their natural course. That's not how they describe it.
No.
They say he was at last convinced that the Father intended to allow natural events to take their course. So that's a... interesting distinction regarding this process of gaining knowledge of the Father's will. You know, it takes work on our part, which is what Jesus was going through. And then he became convinced, right? I don't know. There's a subtlety in there.
That's a good insight, because we would assume that he would constantly be hearing his Father's voice at this time, and surely there may have been times, you know, where he did, you know, in communion.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, he had
but
he had the personalized gesture, which, you know.
And the angels.
Right. But
angels
but the,
were comforting
him. Right. But the thing we forget here very often is that my praying to God is not necessarily a cue to God to talk back to me. You know, there is a choice in how the Father employs his love, his wisdom, his wanting to communicate with us. And especially looking at a time like this, which I think you so, you know, poignantly highlighted, Chuck, there's this idea of it was important for the Master to go through this humanly and to even experience what truly was a dark night of the soul or of spirit, or however you want to look at that, or of the flesh. There are subtle distinctions among people who think about those things, but however you think about it, it really, ultimately, this was a dark night for him. This was as dark as it gets in human experience, and yet we get to the point, which I think we ought to read that latter part of this same section here before we launch into our other reading. But go ahead, Pam, with your point.
I was just going to say that the fact that he had to make his own decision on what to do because the father was not speaking is the exact same thing that happened at the Mount of Transfiguration. It's like there was no voice. There was no, in other words, he had to make his human decision at that point. And it, although even down to the very last drop, like you point out, Chuck, as he had to make that decision himself to reach Godward, you know, and do the godly thing.
There's a just one sentence to frame all of this from the Face of Jesus paper, just the last sentence of that long paragraph where they describe his prayer life in 196.010. And they conclude that paragraph with this comment, which I think applies to both of those situations. They say the secret, speaking of Jesus, the secret of his unparalleled religious life was this consciousness of the presence of God.
Yes.
And he attained it by intelligent prayer and sincere worship, unbroken communion with God, and not by leadings, voices, visions, or extraordinary religious practices.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about that consciousness of the presence of God that gives us this inner conviction about the will of God as best we're able to grasp it. But it's not like a voice, and, you know, we shouldn't be waiting for a voice in our head necessarily. I mean, who knows?
Right.
What the ancestors are capable of, especially in a crisis. But, yeah.
Well, for
generally
one thing,
speaking,
voice,
we shouldn't be waiting for meetings.
Yeah, voice or no voice, vision or no vision, none of it is mechanical.
Yeah.
That's the thing. There is a tendency to, because human beings are so machine-like themselves, I'm sorry to say, I'm sorry if this is a spoiler alert for anybody, but, you know, we're so electrochemical. There are so many things that we want to do by rote. There are so many things we want to push a button and have something happen. And that goes very often in our prayer life as well. You know, where here we are in our prayer life trying to accomplish something, and we'd like a response from God. And when would we like that response? He holds up his hand to his ear. Oh, now. No, not next week. Not next year. No, now. Now. Can I get a response now? You know, and that is, that would be wonderful if God was entirely a machine and we could, or maybe it wouldn't be so wonderful. It might underscore the fact of how machine-like everything is and how we are. In fact, there are choices involved and attitudes of spirit and wisdom combined that somehow come together that make decisions about how God is reciprocating in his communication with us. Now, I realize this intellectually, but I am not saying this as somebody who is so mature that I never want God to be answering me right away. You know, and I'm not claiming to ever hear God answering me right away, but you know, one of the things that's really comforting to me is that there are those, there is that quiet idea of we get leadings, that it's just, you know, it's subtle very often. We get a sense that
very subtle.
You know, this way or that way.
Well, there's that
maybe
thing about
that way would be a little bit better. You know?
That communication of this is the way, you know, that they talk about, you know, at every crossroads.
Right. Yeah.
And
right.
To me, I've interpreted that as a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I've come up with three options but I'm confused or can't decide which is the right way, if I, you know, consider the issue, whatever it is, within the consciousness of God, try to bring this awareness of inner guidance to the question, then doesn't take long before I get a feeling about one of those options. And then,
yeah.
I don't know, I just sort of know that that's the way. You get that, oh, this is the way, you know, kind of feeling. But it's coherent. It makes sense. And then you have an evaluation of that option that rules out the other. And it's kind of a value discernment thing. And that's what I think the spirit can provide, or the Adestra can provide, is that higher value discernment that sorts out some of these questions that, you know, we're always coming up with. But it's kind of communicated as a feeling, I think. At least that's how I experience it.
Well, it's very interesting.
It's logical,
It just shows. Yes. It shows how much our faith and decision making is truly our own, in that even Jesus wasn't given specific things to do. He had to foreknowledge what he needed to do, even though he did not get specific direction when he asked. And so if it happens to him, and it's certainly happening to us.
Yeah, that's kind of the point I was trying to make. Yeah.
Yeah, right. That's the real crux of being human. And Jesus chose to be human. And so, it's the unknown. It's like feast upon that uncertainty. In other words, that's where you're going to, you know, that's where you get to reach for the highest possible concept you can conceive of. This is really an interesting discussion. I hadn't thought about this stuff before, but
right. Well, you know, it kind of recontextualizes for me the idea of doing the Father's will. Instead of seeing that as a burden or something that, you know, oh God, I guess I have to try to do the Father. You know what I mean? It's in fact a gift. The fact that the Father has looked ahead for us and already knows the best course to take, even though we have to figure it out, the fact that he has already figured it out means that the Father's will, as we're trying to discern it, is in fact a gift because it will be the best. It will be the best course forward.
Yes,
you know, the greatest good for the greatest number, for the greatest, you know, all of that.
Yeah,
and he's already figured that out for us. But we have to discern it. We have to know him well enough to have some kind of an idea. And what you're saying about the fruits of the Spirit is good guidance in terms of the character of the Father's will, I think. You know, we know it'll have to be consistent.
Right, exactly.
Those,
right, the character.
With those values, even though the specifics, we still have to try to figure out. But then I think we can get the feeling about it. Right, right. But in any case, just the idea that the Father's will is a gift. It's not a burden.
it is.
The point
and,
of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's hard to realize in the moment a lot of the times, especially at the stage where many of us are. I'm certainly at that stage where I still don't get it. I get a lot more than I did, but I don't get everything. And I'm always amazed at how much our proceeding up, you know, and inward on the psychic circles, that there's always an element of feeling like you're beginning all over again. I don't know how many circles I've made, but I can tell you, I always feel like I'm at the bottom of the ladder going upward, you know, wherever I am. I don't feel like I'm on top very, very long. So speaking of that, this is a very interesting one, because here's someone who made all of his circles, who effectively fused, and now he's dealing with things. I mean, this is the end of his human life, and he's effectively, we're told that what he achieved in human life is normally only achieved by a mortal ascender close to their arrival on paradise, or being mustered into the core of the finality, depending on how you read certain things. I think it's more like, you know, the last part of the first Havona circle. I think it's very instructive that we read this, because here we have an indication of how humanity can actually be functioning close to that level. I mean, it took a lot to get there. It's not where any of us are, but he, and we can't get there because we fuse before we get to this. So we get taken
right.
away. If we get as close to what Jesus did by the time of his baptism, we're gone. You know, we don't get this extra course, you know, in humanity and divinity combined, living it out. But what's interesting about it is here we get this view. To me, Gethsemane is the view of this pinnacle of humanity, that even at that stage, there is always a relative choice of doing the will of the Father or not.
Yeah, right.
There is always that, even at that stage. They indicate it wouldn't have been bad. It wouldn't have been an evil thing for him not to have gone through with to have ended it differently or whatever else.
Right.
But in his human heart, he realized, no, it would still be less than, it would still not be, there would be potential evil in it, in the sense of not doing the Father's will. So we've read as far as paragraph 7. Chuck, do you want to finish up this reading? Because I would like to do this as a departure. It's a very important reading.
So you read this part about the
great drops. Let's start with paragraph 8, the assembled hosts, and read to the end, because it indicates something about how this resolved.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. And, you know, part of what's going on here that I notice is Jesus always has a lack of presumption about the Father's will. He never presumes to know the Father's will. He seeks to know it. Anyway, let me go on here. So he was the last convinced that the Father intended to allow
let's
to take the course.
Let's give people a citation here so they can follow along
sure.
if they like.
Yeah.
We're at 182.3 what?
Paragraph 8. Paper 182, section 3.
I'll put it on the chat.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
This is Alone in Gethsemane is the name of the section. And then starting with paragraph 8, they say that the assembled hosts of a vast creation are now hovered over this scene under the transient joint command of Gabriel, personalized, the gesture of Jesus. Can you imagine? Wow. The division commanders of these armies of heaven have repeatedly been warned not to interfere with these transactions on earth unless Jesus himself should order them to intervene.
Wow.
The experience of parting with the apostles was a great strain on the human heart of Jesus. The sorrow of love bore down on him and made it more difficult to face such a death as he well knew awaited him. He realized how weak and how ignorant his apostles were, and he dreaded to leave them. He well knew that the time of his departure had come, but his human heart longed to find out whether there might not possibly be some legitimate avenue of escape from this terrible plight of suffering and sorrow. And when it had thus sought escape and failed, it was willing to drink the cup. The divine mind of Michael knew he had done his best for the 12 apostles. But the human heart of Jesus wished that more might have been done for them before they would be left alone in the world.
Yeah.
Jesus' heart was being crushed. He truly loved his brethren. He was isolated from his family in the flesh, one of his chosen associates was betraying him. His father Joseph's people had rejected him and thereby sealed their doom as a people with a special mission on earth. His soul was tortured by baffled love and rejected mercy. It was just it was just one of those awful human moments when everything seems to bear down with crushing cruelty and terrible agony. Jesus's humanity was not insensible to this situation of private loneliness, public shame, and the appearance of the failure of his cause. All these sentiments bore down on him with indescribable heaviness. In this great sorrow, his mind went back to the days of his childhood in Nazareth and to his early work in Galilee. At the time of this great trial, there came up in his mind many of those pleasant scenes of his earthly ministry. And it was from these old memories of Nazareth, Capernaum, Mount Hermon, and the sunrise and sunset on the shimmering Sea of Galilee that he soothed himself as he made his human heart strong and ready to encounter the traitor who should so soon betray him. Before Judas and the soldiers arrived, the master had fully regained his customary poise. The spirit had triumphed over the flesh. Faith had asserted itself over all human tendencies to fear or entertain doubt. That's super important. The supreme test of the full realization of the human nature had been met and acceptably passed. The supreme test, meaning it's related to supremacy. Once more, the Son of Man was prepared to face his enemies with equanimity and in the full assurance of his invincibility as a mortal man unreservedly dedicated to the doing of his Father's will. So it's his dedication to the doing of the Father's will.
Yes.
Well, so many things. We could take this and make this the discussion, but let's use it as an illustration, and we can continue the discussion on the other side of our reading of section 4. But this, I'm thank you very much for reading this, and thank you, you two, for a wonderful discussion of this, which is really exemplary. It's the high point. It's really the high point of all of it.
Yeah.
His going through what he is about to go through with the crucifixion and all, he now can bear it all because of what he did here. That's
right.
What's really being indicated.
This was really the crux. Right, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. So and we see at the end he fully regains his customary poise. He hasn't pulled himself up by his bootstraps. He has faithfully chosen to go in partnership with God. And that is what restores it all. These are the lesser things, in a certain sense, that are concomitant with the greater thing of doing the Father's will, which is easy to intellectually realize, not so easy to actually carry through in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow,
we have this example.
Yeah, there's a comment about faith here, too. Even Jesus, knowing who he was, faith still had to assert itself. You know, they say that faith had asserted itself over all human tendencies to fear or entertain doubt.
Yeah.
So even though there was a lot to be afraid of and a lot of reason to doubt what was ahead, nonetheless, faith had asserted itself over all of those human tendencies so he could, you know, go forward.
Undying faith, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the hint there about the supremacy of this is also interesting, mm-hmm. because as we know, after the completion of his bestowal, he achieved supreme sovereignty in Nebadon. In other words, he represents the supreme as much as we're able to comprehend it, even though Jesus isn't God the supreme. Literally, he represents supremacy, the achievement of supremacy.
And the Midwayers are not using that term. They're not just bandying it about and throwing it around in the reading.
Exactly.
So let's do this. Let's, with this as background now, and we can continue some of this later. Let's continue with the reading back on page 58, section 4 mm-hmm. of paper 4, the realization of God. And Pam, okay. could I get you to read that?
Sure. I'll go up to the end of 4. My voice is cracky today, but I'll see how it works.
Okay, well, okay. At whatever point you want to drop it, just
it.
Say,
okay.
Let me pass it, and I'll pick up for you, okay?
Okay. All right, relay.
Good plan.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, number 4, the realization of God. God is the only stationary, self-contained, and changeless being in the whole universe of universes, having no outside, no beyond, no past, and no future. God is purposive energy, creative spirit, and absolute will, and these are self-existent and universal. Since God is self-existent, he is absolutely independent. The very identity of God is inimical to change. Quote, I, the Lord, change not, unquote. God is immutable. But not until you achieve paradise status can you even begin to understand how God can pass from simplicity to complexity, from identity to variation, from quiescence to motion, from infinity to finitude, from the divine to the human, and from unity to duality and triunity. Oh, wow. And God can thus modify the manifestations of his absoluteness because divine immutability does not imply immobility. God has will. He is will. God is the being of absolute self-determination. There are no limits to his universe reactions, save those which are self-imposed. And his free will acts are conditioned only by those divine qualities and perfect attributes which inherently characterize his eternal nature. Therefore, is God related to the universe as the being of final goodness plus a free will of creative infinity. Wow. The Father Absolute is the creator of the central and perfect universe and the father of all other creators. Personality, goodness, and numerous other characteristics God shares with man and other beings. But infinity of will is his alone. God is limited in his creative acts only by the sentiments of his eternal nature and by the dictates of his infinite wisdom. God personally chooses only that which is infinitely perfect, hence the supernal perfection of the central universe. And while the Creator Sons fully share his divinity, even phases of his absoluteness, they are not altogether limited by that finality of wisdom which directs the Father's infinity of will. Mm-hmm. Hence, in the Michael order of sonship, creative free will becomes even more active, wholly divine, and well nigh ultimate, if not absolute. Oh. The Father is infinite and eternal. But to deny the possibility of his volitional self-limitation amounts to a denial of this very concept of his volitional absoluteness. I'll go on. God's absoluteness pervades all seven levels of universe reality. And the whole of this absolute nature is subject to the relationship of the Creator to his universe creature family. Precision may characterize Trinitarian justice in the universe of universes, but in all his vast family relationship with the creatures of time, the God of universe is governed by divine sentiment. First and last, eternally, the infinite God is a father. Of all the possible titles which he might appropriately be known, I have been instructed to portray the God of all creation as the universal father. In God the Father, free will performances are not ruled by power, nor are they guided by intellect alone. The divine personality is defined as consisting in spirit and manifesting himself to the universes as love. Therefore, in all his personal relations with the creature personalities of the universes, the first source and center is always and consistently a loving father. God is a father in the highest sense of the term. He is eternally motivated by the perfect idealism of divine love, and that tender nature finds its strongest expression and greatest satisfaction in loving and being loved. In science, God is the first cause. In religion, the universal and loving Father. In philosophy, the one being who exists by himself, not dependent on any other being for existence, but beneficently conferring reality of existence on all things and upon on all other beings. But it requires revelation to show that the first cause of science and the self-existent unity of philosophy are the God of religion, full of mercy and goodness, and pledged to effect the eternal survival of his children on earth. We crave the concept of the infinite, but we worship the experience idea of God. Our anywhere and anytime capacity to grasp the personality and divinity factors of our highest concept of deity. The consciousness of a victorious human life on earth is born of that creature faith which dares to challenge each recurring episode of existence, just what we were talking about, when confronted with the awful spectacle of human limitations, by the unfailing declaration, even if I cannot do this, there lives in me one who can and will do it. A part of the Father Absolute of the universe of universes. And that is, quote, the victory which overcomes the world, even your faith, unquote.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Pam. And I dare to say you did this in partnership with God, because God got you through the end, even though you were afraid for your voice.
Yeah, good job.
Anyway, yeah, good enough.
Nicely done.
Thank you.
Well, there's tons.
Wow.
Here. Tons here. There's something that strikes me in paragraph 4, but let me turn it over to the two of you. Is there something that you'd like to speak about earlier on in the reading?
Well, actually, I was wondering if we could sort out that last sentence.
Okay,
the victory which overcomes the world, even your faith.
Yeah.
I've always been puzzled by that. Are they saying victory that overcomes the world, even your lack of faith? Is that what they're saying? Or are they saying that it's your faith that gives you the victory which overcomes the world?
It seems to me the latter.
Yeah, the syntax is a little peculiar, though.
it's beyond, yeah. beyond your faith. It means beyond your faith, because faith is, I mean, that's what was interesting in talking about Jesus's faith a little while ago. But it's, what is it? There's a wisdom experience that transcends faith. And I forget where that part is, but faith is what we take until we get more God experience, I think.
Direct experience of spirit.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the term is, but there's like a wisdom component of experience that transcends
right.
faith, and that's what I think they're saying here.
Mm-hmm.
Victory,
you know,
which overcomes, which overcomes the world. You know, that means like even the world of finitude in a way.
Uh-huh.
You
yeah.
know.
Right, and,
well,
and where you. Sense. And where you had this idea of even your lack of faith, I just wouldn't go quite that far as referring to it as lack of your lack of faith, but maybe a better way of putting it, even mm-hmm. what you may lack in your faith.
Right. That's
because
yeah.
without faith mm-hmm. in the Father, this is not going to operate at all. But
uh-huh.
if, but nobody's faith is perfect, although we could say Michael's, as Jesus of Nazareth, his faith was perfect.
Well, he still struggled.
But that
though.
Faith was, he still struggled. It was still
yeah.
a struggle,
yeah.
but it was a perfect struggle.
Yeah, his faith did finally kick in, right?
Well, no, it didn't finally kick in. It was always there. It was always
right.
there. Whatever was manifesting in the intellect, that's what
uh-huh.
we need to understand.
Well,
what
I meant is that the faith had asserted itself. That's what I'm,
Exactly. And that faith exerting mm-hmm. itself is not an intellectual exercise. And it can happen in spite of what's going on in the intellect. That's the thing. You know, the intellect
yes.
may go back and forth, and you may still choose to do the right thing. But in any case, that's what I would say, I would concede to you, and I appreciate you bringing up the question, because I've had questions about this too. I think most people have.
Huh. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
the
so.
I think there's double entendre in it, actually, because the victory which overcomes the world is you having faith, but there's this element of even your faith comes from the Father. And so
oh, yes.
your faith may not be perfect in every situation. That victory that overcomes whatever it is you may lack in your faith at that point, if you're sincere of heart, the Father is there with you,
yes.
bringing you up.
And your faith grows.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. If only we could always realize that.
So maybe they're saying we shouldn't be afraid of our self-conscious thoughts about our limitations of our faith. So we
well, they
go
do
forward.
Say that. They do.
Yeah.
They do say that very clearly in the last paragraph
right.
of page of paper 34, section 7. 8, and we all know it, and that is, having started out on the way of life everlasting, having accepted the assignment and received your orders to advance, do not fear the dangers of human forgetfulness and mortal inconstancy. Do not be troubled with doubts of failure or by perplexing confusion. Do not falter and question your status and standing. For in every dark hour, at every crossroad in the forward struggle, the Spirit of Truth will always speak, saying, this is the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that does parallel what they say here, where they say, yes. even if I cannot do this, or even if I think I cannot do this, there lives in me one who can and will do it.
Yeah.
So that's sort of suggesting the same idea, you know, this awareness of our limitations. But even with that awareness, we can still go forward with this faith that there is one within us who will guide us and help us. You know, and that thing within us is actually part of the Father Absolute of the universe of universes. You know, which is pretty astounding, you know, to try to wrap our minds around that.
It really is.
But, yeah. Yeah, that's a great. I love that passage that you read there, Andre. I've pondered it many times.
Well, it seems to be them, you know, it's one of the places for sure. If there were any questions about, you know, black and white thinking here, this immediately tells you that they recognize fully this is an evolutionary struggle. They recognize that fully.
Uh-huh.
So,
Well, that earlier, just to finish that off, the earlier sentence in that same final paragraph, they talk about creature faith, which dares to challenge each recurring episode of existence when confronted with the awful spectacle of human limitations.
Yeah.
So they're acknowledging our consciousness of our limitations, but they're telling us, come on, just, you know, go for it. You know, if you have faith and you're seeking the Father's will, it'll work out somehow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and speaking of limitations, there is that other statement that is also sort of corroborating that, where they talk about in paper 100, section 6, paragraph 4, they speak of limitations again, where they're talking about, you know, our faith walk, and the self has surrendered to the intriguing drive of an all-encompassing motivation which imposes heightened self-discipline, lessens emotional conflict, and makes mortal life truly worth living. Well, that's nice. The upside of faith, the morbid recognition of human limitations is changed. So there's recognition to the natural consciousness of mortal shortcomings associated with moral determination and spiritual aspiration to attain the highest universe and super universe goals. And this intense striving for the attainment of supermortal ideals is always characterized by increasing patience, forbearance, fortitude, and tolerance. But that, to me, it's always been interesting that they acknowledge our spiritual psychology and what we often have to deal with when you're making this walk through life. Yeah.
And we can achieve that in our current state and situation. Doesn't mean we become God on paradise, but we can. I mean, the one thing I've always have to realize about the idea of doing the Father's will, that wouldn't be put forward as a goal if it wasn't possible. If it was impossibly difficult or out of reach, impossibly out of reach, they wouldn't be teasing us with the possibility. I mean, it has to be doable. But it has to be doable within our limitations. So
I
that's
agree.
What makes it, kind of makes it so intriguing.
I've jettisoned this idea of, you know, the nuns, you know, waving in front of me the saints, because you're never going to get there, you know.
Oh.
You know, that's an awful way to grow up, I will tell you.
Yeah, really.
Thinking that these are, they did it, and, you know, most of us are never, ever going to get there.
Why bother?
Yeah, these are one-offs, exactly. They were special. you know?
That's kind of discouraging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always reminded of an impossible standard.
Exactly.
I mean, it could be motivating maybe and inspiring if done in the right way, but it sounds a little discouraging.
Well, you know, all of the saints ultimately ignored the authorities around them in a certain sense.
Huh.
They prayed on their own, or if they were told they needed to do something, you know, they prayed in spite of somebody saying you needed to do this, this, and that, or whatever. You know, in spite of many of the directions they got from outside. It's a statement about how important it is to honor your personality, your spiritual individuality, and to make your way on your own. We all make mistakes. I make them every day.
But to not lose that sense of inner conviction.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's one more short line here I think fits in pretty well, if you don't mind if I read it. This is the famous opening line from Paper 110, in relation of adjusters to individual mortals, where they say that the endowment of imperfect beings with freedom tails inevitable tragedy. And it is the nature of the perfect ancestral deity to universally and affectionately share these sufferings and loving companionship.
Yeah.
Nice.
You know, that's kind of where we get that capacity, that victory capacity.
Yeah, this is how they...
It's from this realization.
Yes, and this is how they introduce to us our relation to thought adjusters and their relationship to us. This is the single sentence paragraph that they use to say, look, this is the human condition. The very next paragraph is about the beauty of the love of the thought adjuster for us. That too is part of the human condition.
Yeah. Well, and I think if there was one statement in the book that expresses the theodicy, if I'm getting that word right, of the Urantia book, it would probably be this one. You know, that issue about theodicy, you know, God is good, why is there evil in the world and all that.
Yes, right. Yeah.
This is what resolves that.
Taking a page out of Byron Bellizzo's writing, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. I was just thinking about that.
Yeah. Well, very good. Well, let's look at some other things here because go ahead, Pam. Let's go with you.
I was just going to say, the term sentiment came up twice. Paragraph 4 and 5. And it's when they start talking about the Father Absolute. And he's limited, number 4, it says, God is limited in his creative acts only by the sentiments of his eternal nature and by the dictates of infinite wisdom. Sentiments. Mm-hmm. And then in number 5, it talks about down below it says precision may characterize Trinitarian justice, but in all his vast family relationship with the creatures of time, the God of universes is governed by divine sentiment. First and eternally,
it's a very interesting observation.
First and eternally, the infinite God is a father. Yes.
Yeah. What do you make of that, Pam?
Pam dropped. So that's what happened. Yeah, but she'll be back. I'll look for her. She was reading that last sentence that followed that. First and last, eternally, the infinite God is a father. So very good point, Pam. And in bringing this out, somehow they're wanting us to know that God has feelings.
Right, exactly.
God is limited in his creative acts only by the sentiments of his eternal nature. Yeah. And so.
Yeah, I love that.
Are you there, Pam? So what else did you want to say about that? We were talking about it a little bit, but the idea that God has feelings is what they're telling us here, and those feelings make a difference.
Yeah, combined with the dictates of his infinite wisdom. wisdom.
Pam, are you there? You know,
maybe
somehow Pam's number came up twice. Pam, are you there?
Huh.
No, it's dropped again. Okay.
Well, sure she'll be back.
Yeah.
But they
just fun with Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, right. But then they tie that idea of sentiment to the statement about first and last, eternally, the infinite God is a father. So these are father-like sentiments, or the sentiments of a father that are governing or guiding the father's attitudes.
Yes.
Everything he does.
Pam, you should be back with us now. Are you muted, Pam? Somehow.
Okay.
Hello, Amar. There you are.
So sorry. I got a phone call that came in and I messed it up. Okay. Hi.
Yes. Hi.
All right.
I had faith I would get back to you.
Oh, right. Faith has been very important today.
Overcame the world.
He overcame the world of technology. Anyway, the whole idea of divine sentiment residing in the infinite God as a father is like just what a sweet term, divine sentiment.
A very important qualifier there. The adjective.
Yeah.
You know, your adjective book is all about adjectives.
And it's italicized.
Yes, it is.
So, anyway.
Yeah.
So there's this element as well in paragraph 2 and paragraph 4 that then gets, you know, a little more philosophical. And this whole idea of God's changelessness, his immutability. I, the Lord, change not. The very identity of God is inimical to change. There's nothing that can change God. But he's not static. So they go on to say, not until you achieve paradise status can you even begin to understand how God can pass from simplicity to complexity, identity to variation, quiescence to motion, infinity to finitude, divine to the human, unity to duality, and triunity. How is all of that possible? And God can thus modify the manifestations of his absoluteness because divine immutability does not imply immobility. God has will, is will. Now, what does that last sentence mean to you? Because it's a very interesting distinction that changelessness does not mean static nature, at least not a static nature that does not have the possibility of moving out of that static nature.
Would that mean he's an evolving God?
Well
the Supreme.
Well.
Well, the thought adjusters, you know, they get better at being thought adjusters. And the whole point of the Father's partnering with us is to experience our experience. You know, speak about that.
Right.
Yeah, but immobility. In other words, he can move around within his immutability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, and that interestingly, you know, so when they say something like, you know, that he can move from infinity to finitude, I think that brings up what you're talking about with the Supreme. Now, the Supreme is not the Father, but all deity is absolutely unified. And the Paradise Trinity, we are told, does function not only on the level of the absolute, on the level of the ultimate as the Trinity of ultimacy, and on the level of the Supreme, you know, of the finite rather, as the Trinity of supremacy. So there is that aspect of the nature of God. Does God become that himself? Well, Chuck just pointed out the thought adjusters effectively, while being an absolute fragment of God, are capable of experience. Mm-hmm. What does that do to a thought adjuster? Does it change the thought adjuster? It seems to. Mm-hmm. How do you change something that's absolute? How do you change a fragment of God?
Because it's
focused. So this is all very mysterious.
Because it's a focus, though. It's a focus, an individualized focus of an aspect of this immutability. In other words, it's part of the transition from infinity to finitude because of the communication that's going on with finitude. I don't know. Is that making any sense?
Well, kind of. Kind of. I mean, there's an aspect of the adjuster that I'm sure is changeless. You know, the divinity or spiritual absoluteness or whatever words we come up with. You know, that aspect of the adjuster is changeless. But whenever God gets involved with the finite, with time and space, with everything that's going on with the evolution of the Supreme, there's development. There's experience, in other words. So the fact that the adjuster is capable of experience and, in a sense, learning from that experience, you know, they talk about experienced adjusters are more effective or more powerful. And, you know, they're better able to reach the human mind than an inexperienced adjuster. So something about the experience of indwelling, particularly repeated experiences of indwelling, gives the adjuster, I guess, a sort of a store of reference points or, you know, this worked, this didn't, kind of. I don't know to call it knowledge or how do you refer to that, but it's apparently a real thing. So, you know, it's fascinating.
It's like the adjuster is learning bite by bite how a human finite makes decisions and grows individualized. In other words, my adjuster is learning how I proceed. Yours is learning how you proceed.
Right, right. Very intimate.
Very, very.
Yes.
And that's all a part of the infinitude of God. I mean, this. Oh my gosh! You know, all the ways he can learn about his creation. And how his creation evolves. Yeah. How his time and space evolves. Yeah. How his time space creatures evolve. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Well, I was just thinking, it's interesting how they say that the adjusters work with a mind model. You know, they have a mind model for us before they even begin their indwelling. And that they study and practice on the mind model. And get some idea of what it's going to be like to dwell each one of us before they even arrive. But then once they hit the ground and actually begin their indwelling, then they have to deal with the realities of our mind and the living decisions that we're making every moment. And that's kind of, I'm sure, a very different stage of their, not only their relationship to us, but also their own development, to actually be working with living mind as opposed to a mind model. But they begin with a mind model, so at least have some idea how to get started. I don't know.
Yeah.
All very imponderable.
Yeah.
But it's wrapped up in what we're reading here, though. I mean, immutability. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just looked it up. It does mean, they put it here, unchanging over time or unable to be changed.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it's that higher nature that doesn't change. But that doesn't mean that, well, they say it doesn't imply immobility. Maybe that's another way of saying active engagement or something like that.
Right.
Or even a certain kind of learning from experience. I mean, the Supreme is all about that, but that seems to go on with the Father, too, in some sense, that there is a learning from experience and a curiosity, too. I mean, the desire on God's part, you know, to share our experience. And, you know, the issues of foreknowledge there also come into play. You know, does the Father really know all of our decisions before we make them? Maybe.
Yeah, but that's a good philosophical discussion.
Right, that's another whole issue.
Well, even if we don't know the answer to that, we do know the answer to he's never surprised. What
right.
does that mean?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. He's never surprised.
And his foreknowledge takes
They just
away.
Don't want to scare us straight. They prefer if we were able to act a little more spontaneously by not being scared straight all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Anyway.
Well, so this
there's
idea
there.
Then is interesting, the changelessness of God. And then in the last sentence of, you know, talking about the Father Absolute in paragraph 4, which we read that part about sentiment, you know, God personally chooses only that which is infinitely perfect. Then they go on and they say creative free will becomes even more active, holy, divine, well-nigh ultimate, if not absolute, in the Michael order of sonship. And then they state this: the Father is infinite and eternal, but to deny the possibility of his volitional self-limitation amounts to a denial of the very concept of his volitional absoluteness. Very, very interesting, convoluted, Koan-like kind of statement about the nature of God. Okay, to be absolute, he has to be able to do absolutely everything. That includes self-limiting.
Yes.
Oh, but wait a minute. If he self-limits himself, he's not absolute.
He chooses to divest.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And self-limit.
Right.
And self-limit.
Delegate.
That allows.
He delegates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Think of everything he delegates to the Creator Son. There was something here. Where did that go?
There's so much here.
Well, in that, what do you?
Before
what do you
we proceed
sense?
On,
okay.
Go ahead with your point now, Chuck. Did you find it?
Yeah. Just in what we were just looking at, I was puzzling over this a little bit when we first read it. Maybe I'm not puzzling so much now, but maybe I am. It says, the Creator Son fully share his divinity, even phases of his absoluteness. They are not altogether limited by that finality of wisdom, which directs the Father's infinity of will, saying they're not altogether limited, meaning that they, and then they say, hence, in the Michael order of sonship, creative free will becomes even more active. So there's a almost kind of a lifting of restraint or something associated with the creator son. I mean, it seemed peculiar when we first read it to hear that they're not altogether limited by that finality of wisdom, which directs the Father's infinity of will. I mean, I was—I just sort of assumed they would be.
Okay.
But they're saying they're not.
They're given more.
So it's like they're given more mobility, right?
More mobility, yes.
Or something like that.
No, yeah.
More latitude.
So what does that mean, ultimately? I mean, or absolutely, I don't know. it seems, you know, we're told that each Michael is the absolute personification of, you know, a unique and absolute thought of the universal Father combined with a similar expressive thought of the eternal Son.
Eternal Son.
Achieving unity in the, essentially the bringing into being. It's hard to call an absolute being brought into existence, but the Michaels have an absolute, at least aspect to their nature, if they are not absolute personifications. They're not absolute personalities in that right, but they're definitely personifications of an absolute concept.
Mm-hmm.
And there's hundreds of thousands of them, we're told. Well over 700,000 now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when that creator son, you know, comes into being, that would indicate that if there is an absolute concept, that is not the same as every other absolute concept. And is that part of what is not characterized by that fullness of wisdom, that finality of wisdom, as they say it, with regard to particular aspects? In other words, their original nature is designed to function in a particular way, and they will act out of that nature and not out of some other nature, and that allows them greater freedom of expression in this particular
latitude,
way within their local universe. Exactly. Good word.
And the fact that they plunge into humanity, you know, the lowest form of will creature, and the in the flesh, and the Father never goes to that. He only goes through the thought adjuster in spirit. So maybe that's also a part of the Michael son's uniqueness. That makes them, I don't know, what is it we're talking about here? We're talking about this immobility within the immutability aspect of coming from paradise that gives them more latitude than the Father. It has something, I can't help but think it has something to do with the fact that they can actually become physical beings.
Right.
And the Father can experience that through the thought adjusters, but not to the same degree a Michael son can.
Yeah.
He actually becomes one of us.
Right.
Which is like remarkable or beyond remarkable to even ponder. But we're kind of talking about what they mean by finality of wisdom and how that can actually be a limitation.
Oh, right. Yes.
Apparently. I don't know. I mean, that scene in the Garden of Gethsemane. Maybe that kind of is an illustration of that.
Okay.
You know, Jesus as the greater son as the human Jesus had to find wisdom in that moment. And, you know, mm-hmm. it was DIY, you know. I mean, he was seeking the Father's will, and the Father was present with him, but yet still he had to find that wisdom. So it wasn't just given in a sense.
Right. And that's
which would have been a limitation on his experience as a bona fide human. He had to make discovery.
How do you achieve?
Just like we do. Yeah.
How do you achieve finality of wisdom, you know, experientially if you already have it?
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So it's important that he does have to find that in his own way.
Wisdom experience. Wisdom. I want to somehow tie in experience with finality of wisdom experience.
Mm-hmm. And that's what brings in the whole dimension of supremacy into it.
Yes, right.
I mean, part of the role of the Creator Son is to achieve supremacy, or relative supremacy anyway.
Right.
This is such a thing.
Yeah, from the top down and from the bottom up.
Right, yeah, simultaneously.
Yeah, simultaneously.
Well, what's interesting
world without end, amen.
Yeah, where we read in paper 182 in Gethsemane seemed to be the achievement of that pinnacle. Yes, he still had more to go through. He still had more experience to do, but now he was ready for that experience. And to say he passed the supreme test is almost to say, whatever would have happened at that point, everything would have worked out okay, because he had effectively passed that test. He didn't have to die on a cross. Pilate could have done the right thing. Herod could have done the right thing.
Right.
Sanhedrin could have gone through and changed their mind and said, oh, you're right. Our power is less important, and in fact, it will be enhanced ultimately if we follow the truth. Yeah, let's go. Let's get on with this. Yeah.
It's starting to make sense to me. Yes.
Well, then there was Claudia's note too. The note from his wife.
Right.
So he had paid more attention to that, or taken that more seriously.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, I think he did, but he was struggling with how to cope with it. But she warned him, and she even talked to him, I think, earlier, too. Look, I have nothing to do with this, you know? And if he had taken the counsel of his own wife more seriously, that things could have turned out differently as a result of that.
It just wasn't the age to do that.
Well, you know, I mean, it always is.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Yeah.
As if it is today.
Yeah.
But
wives always have their input one way or another.
Of course. But it does show how Jesus reached for the Father's higher will than all the humans he was surrounded by. They rejected the call to higher truth. And but that was a good point that, yes, maybe they could have changed. Maybe they could have made a different decision. Any one of those that you mentioned. But, you know, they didn't. And who knows what this planet would have been like if one of them had, you know.
Imagine what Michael could have taught for another 5 years.
Oh my gosh.
10 years.
Oh my gosh.
20 years. 30 years.
They were determined.
Dare I say 40 years, living as long as John, his youngest apostle.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
all of that, you know, whatever.
What might we have as a story
and where might I, our world be going? But it wasn't to be. Because evolutionarily, evidently,
we weren't collectively there.
We couldn't handle it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what comes to mind is that beautiful film of that you participated in, Andre Gary, on Revelation. It was
the new one.
It was it was very fascinating for me to see the graphic of where Dalmatia, how high Dalmatia went and how low it descended to Adam and Eve, and then only came back a little bit with both Melchizedek and Jesus. And it's like they were showing, like, the Urantia book is equal to where Dalmatia was in the evolutionary scheme of things. And it was like, how did they even determine that, to put that in the Revelation story here? But I thought that was very fascinating, because does that mean that we are similar to what the success of Dalmatia? In other words, is our planetary mortal epic similar to where Dalmatia was? I find that hard to believe.
I don't know if that's necessarily all of what's trying to be conveyed there, but I think it's great that it's bringing up thoughts like that. I know, you know, Gary's intention was not necessarily to have a one-on-one correspondence. Now, this dip here in the line means this at this point.
Right.
It wasn't completely, but it was meant to convey the general sense of some of that. And clearly they indicate that, I mean, there are some things that if we went through the 10 different, what did they call them? Commissions, basically, you know, the commissions of the staff of the prince, you know, the commission on health and the commission on religion and all of those kinds of things, the commission on justice, you know, that's, those are paraphrases. Those aren't the actual names. But if you look at that, you know, well, we've done pretty well on health lately. We're getting better. How far have we gone from where that dispensation would have taken us? It would have taken us, you know, to the point where the science of the Adamic dispensation would have started to uplift us, and we entered into a truly scientific age at that point. In that sense, we're probably further ahead. The Commission on Industry and Trade or whatever, we're doing fantastic there.
Mm-hmm.
How about justice on Earth? You know, there might be a few areas where we're still wanting in with regard to all of the commissions.
It was fun to see that comparison on that wonderful video.
Nice to see that graphic. Yeah, well, I'm sure Gary appreciates that. He's on the board, and kudos to Gary for really a wonderful conception, really well executed. Nice job, Gatti.
Yeah.
Nice job, Gatti.
Well, I wonder if I could throw in another kind of piece in
here
that fits with what we're talking about. I just did a search on the phrase revelation of man to God, and this comes up in three places. But one place is in his bestowal sort of instructions or bestowal commission. He says, equally with this ministry of new revelation and augmented interpretation of the Paradise Father to the human and superhuman type of mind, you will also so function as to make a new revelation of man to God, exhibit in your one short life in the flesh, as it has never before been seen in all Nebadon, the transcendent possibilities attainable by a God-knowing human being during the short career of mortal existence. And it goes on, but it's so, I think, fascinating or ironic or something that the other place where they mention this is in paper 184, section 4, which was the hour of humiliation. And,
yeah.
You know, that's when he was left alone with the guards and whoever else. You know, they were mistreating him and doing all these terrible
right.
things to his these physical attacks upon the unresisting Son of Man. And they say all these insults, taunts, and blows fell upon Jesus. He was undefending but not defenseless. Jesus was not vanquished, merely uncontending in the material sense. And then they go on in that final paragraph of that section, 184.4.6, to say that these are the moments of the Master's greatest victory in all his long and eventful career as a maker, upholder, and savior of a vast and far-flung universe.
Mm-hmm.
Having lived to the full a life of revealing God to man, Jesus is now engaged in making a new and unprecedented revelation of man to God. So
yeah.
you can see how he's fulfilling the bestowal commission, you know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
that was put before him before he even entered into it. And it's in those moments where he's being the most horribly and cruelly mistreated
yes.
that
yes.
he makes this new and unprecedented revelation of man to God. Not that other,
yeah, right.
you know, other parts of his experience didn't also include that, but they say that these are the moments of the Master's greatest victory in all his long and eventful. Now, and they're not even just talking about his human bestowal. These are the moments of the Master's greatest victories in all his long and eventful career, his entire
yeah.
career. As a maker,
yeah.
upholder, and savior of a vast and far-flung
yes.
universe. I mean,
yeah.
kind
he
of
was,
put
he
that
was,
together.
He was holy God and holy man at this time. Yeah, that's the Bible, you know, I think, talks about that.
Some,
you know,
it is revealing
at
the potential,
at that moment,
a human potential. Yeah.
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Something is being seen that had never been seen before in Nevada.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Yeah. Very,
yeah,
very
wonderful.
Good.
Wonderful.
But that's not what you might expect. You might think, well, it was, you know, his best sermon he ever gave, you know, was maybe that's when he did it, you know. But no. It's when he's sitting there seeing undefending as he's being mistreated. So that says a lot about being godlike.
Well, and
you know,
in the
face
the anguish,
of adversity.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
and the anguish and sorrow. All in other words, he was the depth of human emotion. You know, aligned with the reach of this highest possible choice. You know.
Yeah.
Within a human mind, a divine mind that chose to stay human, you know, and yet reach for the divine will. It's like, what a
yeah.
talk about contrast, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, the next sentence kind of says that in that paragraph from paper 184. They say that, you know, after they say that he's making a new and unprecedented revelation of man to God, then they say, Jesus is now revealing to the world the final triumph over all fears of creature personality isolation.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
I think that's super important in terms of revealing our potential, revealing man to God, revealing what we're actually capable of. Because anything that Jesus did as a human, theoretically at least, that can become a standard for all of us. So this triumph over all fears of creature personality isolation. I mean, just think about how often we feel isolated or have felt isolated during our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know about you guys, mm-hmm. but it's kind of in the nature of our situation. You know, that we can feel so self-contained, just bouncing off the inside of our head, you know, not realizing that we can reach beyond ourselves. And, you know, there's fear, so much fear associated with isolation. So the fact that he triumphs over all of that, you know, is clearly a very important thing. And then they say the Son of Man has finally achieved the realization. The Son of Man has finally achieved the realization of identity as the Son of God. And that's something that we all also can do in our own way. I mean, we're not going to become the Creator Son, but we are sons and daughters of God.
Mm-hmm.
And do we have the potential to achieve an ever fuller realization of that identity? And that's part of, I think, what our whole ascension career is about.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we can look, as always, to Jesus blazing the trail or giving us the demonstration of what we can also do. And I think that's kind of part of what...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Part of the purpose of his soul was to do that. And not only for us, but for all creatures in his universe. You know, they say trillions of beings look, take one more look at him on the cross and say, okay, mm-hmm. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to go forward just like he did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's all pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing to imagine. You know, and again, it doesn't mean that we're necessarily right there, but when we are, you know, God help us, confronted with the awful spectacle of our human limitation in some egregious kind of, you know, happening that's occurring. I just saw a story about these wonderful Ukrainian women that went on an operation to retrieve their children behind enemy lines. And, you know, imagining just having to rise through those emotions of a mother, you know, for their children, the anguish and everything that represents, not to mention all the other kinds of things that can happen in life, but that was,
oh my gosh,
an example of some of the poignancy of you know, the difficulty of what people are going through on this world all over and over and over again. And here we're being, what we get from Michael doing that, from seeing that in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, is this idea that we could do that. We could aspire to do that. And it's difficult to imagine fully the inner state of Jesus of Nazareth in getting there, but we can aspire to that. And we have within us one who can bring us there, and that is our Father in the form of the indwelling presence of God, the thought adjuster.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think when they say that Jesus, you know, finally understood, however they put that, that it was the Father's will that those final events of his life should take their natural course. You know, he essentially put himself in human hands.
Yes. Oh,
and
yeah.
Allowed events to take their natural course, whatever that turned out to be. And so it was a human-to-human thing. So the idea of the revelation of man to God involved that whole set of circumstances, which was all very human. You know, we were just talking about Pilate and the others, you know, the priest, Jewish priests, and the Sanhedrin, and, you know, everything that was wrapped up on a human level in that scene was to be left undisturbed, you know, allow these humans to do what they're going to do. And that'll be part of this revelation of man to God, because Jesus in that situation as a human had to engage with that according to, you know, his divinity, but his human divinity.
Right.
And that that was part of it. In other words, if anything was done to mess with that situation, it would not have been this fulfillment of that potential of the revelation of human nature to God.
Right.
Right. You know, I keep seeing the contrast, you know, between the lesser human choices and the, you know, human divine choices of Jesus. And, I mean, there's a beauty in that. You know, isn't the definition of beauty as a unification of contrasts?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what a sterling moment. I mean, not just in Nebadon, but in all of supremacy that, you know, we had such an example of demonstration of beauty, you know, the amazing contrast of the choices between good and evil and your imperfection and perfection, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's staggering.
Yeah, yeah. And the highest expression of that was Jesus in the midst of being tortured.
That's my point. That's my point. Yeah.
Yeah. How he handled that.
Yeah. Oh, it's just. Oh.
I know.
Well,
brings up so
much. No.
We're in our last minute or two. Last thoughts.
Boy, that was
on. It did, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it really did.
The realization of God. There, you know, the last part is in focusing on the God of love in paragraph six. In God the Father, free will performances are not ruled by power, nor are they guided by intellect alone. The divine personality is defined as consisting in spirit and manifesting himself to the universes as love. This is very, very important, because, you know, we go through the whole entire Old Testament, and there's so many demonstrations in the Old Testament, you know, regardless, forget the idea of what you find credible or not, but they're all demonstrations of power. How God smited his enemies. But, you know, but all of that is being countered here. Let's end on the note here, since we only have a minute left, we are revealed an infinite Father, and that nature is dominated by love. Love is the nature of that infinite Father. Well, thank you for a wonderful discussion, you guys. Go ahead.
And that was the essence of how he handled that abuse.
Yes.
He was loving the people who were doing that to him.
Yes.
He didn't try to overpower them.
No, he didn't.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you. We will pick up with...
serve them. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Erroneous Ideas of God next week. I thank you, Pamela Chaddick. I thank you, Chuck Thurston. This has been a wonderful discussion. I'm Andre Rodatis, and
you've
been
Andre.
Listening to the
God
Cosmic and Citizen.
Our listeners and our chat group, thank you. Thank you. Love you.
Mm-hmm.
This has been wonderful. Thank you, everybody on the board, Bob, Gary, Isadora, Gina, Kim, Skyway, and Zassi. Thank you very much for listening.
Right.
And of course, Von Fosmo listening in. Good to have you all here. Until next week.
All right.
Bye for now.
All right.
Love Bye for now. Love
Have
you.
Have a great week.
Love you too.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.